Good afternoon. I'm tempted to try to comment on all three of the presentations today, but the truth is that there's only one that I know a lot about. So I'm just going to say a couple things about the other two, and I apologize to the presenters. It's a reflection of my own limited experience rather than the quality of your presentations that I'm not spending more time on it. On the hometown associations, one of the things that I found fascinating was something that I always believed, which is that organizing is transformative. And it's not just that it empowers people, but it also changes priorities and the issues which people think are important. Needless to say, somebody in public life, somebody in politics, really believes in organizing, and it was kind of good to hear that organizing that starts out sort of ethnic-based can be transformed into real political activity and ratchet up political participation. On the neighborhood development side, I just have a couple stories to tell that kind of complement what Janet was talking about on the basis of my own experience. Some of you have done some work about TIFs, Tax Increment Financing Districts, and one of the interesting things that I found, I have a number of TIFs in my ward. Most of them, frankly, are focused on particular affordable housing developments. They were created for that purpose, and that's their main mission. So there isn't a lot of back and forth about what they should be involved in. But a couple of them are much broader and have a broader mandate for supporting community development. And in 2000, as we were creating one in Hyde Park, the community in which I live that's part of my ward, I asked the administration, the city administration, to incorporate into the TIF implementing legislation a TIF advisory council, a body that would monitor and kind of supervise the expenditure of TIF funds. And for one reason after another, they were unable or unwilling to bring that TIF implementing legislation to the city council, and finally just asked him point blank what was the matter, and it was that I was insisting on including this TIF advisory council. And if I took that out of the legislation, then the creation of the TIF would go forward. And I said, okay, what the heck? I mean, I will do this. I'll create my own TIF advisory council. I would have preferred to have something sanctioned by the city, but you know, if the condition for getting the TIF in place is that you have this voluntary rather than government-sanctioned advisory council, I'll go ahead and do it that way. But the administration has refused to put into any of the enabling legislation for TIFs these advisory councils that would provide some community input about the way in which the resources got expended. The second story is about conservation community councils. We have one in the 4th Ward for North Kenwood, Oakland. It was proposed in 1989 and it began its work in 1991, just before I was elected alderman. And I asked someone in the planning department afterwards, that this group has been meeting virtually every month, and actually Mary Patillo is a member, since 1991, so 18 years. And I asked somebody in the planning department why there weren't more in the city, why the city hadn't used this vehicle for community involvement, you know, basically everywhere since it was working so well in North Kenwood, Oakland. And basically what I was told was it was too staff intensive, and after they figured out how much work it was, they decided it wasn't worth doing anymore. So that this is not a vehicle for community involvement or for review of community development projects that they decided they were going to use anywhere else in the city. That was the last one. As far as I can tell, there are never going to be any more conservation community areas or conservation community councils. So there's been a deliberate effort to sort of, not sort of, minimize, marginalize, and surely not sanction a community advisory process in a variety of arenas, which has, needless to say, impacted neighborhood development. Okay, the last thing is one I know a lot about. And that's the battle over Walmart. Since I was in the council at the time, oddly enough. The first part of what I want to talk about is personal. What happened in 2004 when these matters, when the two Walmart proposals came before the city council, one of which passed and one of which failed, okay? Now, Alderman Mitz on the west side went around to all of her colleagues and asked them for their support. And she went to churches and community groups on the west side, not just in her ward, but all over the west side, and asked them for support as well, and worked for months really diligently to try to marshal support for Walmarts. Her proposal for a Walmart in her ward passed the city council, even though there was substantial labor opposition. Yours truly walked off the floor rather than vote against her. I told her that I couldn't support Walmart, that I hated Walmart, I thought it was the worst company in America, but I was going to be respectful of her good faith efforts to try to secure the support of her colleagues and her community. On the Southside Walmart, which was voted on that same day, it failed. And it failed in part because, not because people's view of Walmart had changed, but because the alderman of the 21st Ward took an entirely different tack in dealing with his colleagues. One of his colleagues, an adjacent neighbor, basically tried to talk to him about how Walmarts might impact his commercial strip and the mom-and-pop businesses on that strip. And I'll clean up his language a little bit. The response was, screw you, this is my ward, I think this is good for my community, and you ought to support it as a matter of aldermanic prerogative. Needless to say, he did not secure the support of his colleagues, nor did he mobilize community groups and churches, and when it came to a vote in the city council, it did not pass. So there was a, I guess I would say there was a real personal element to this, although there is respect for aldermanic prerogative when you say screw you, when you try to talk to your neighbor about issues that are of concern to both of you, you're not going to have a very positive result. The second part of it is the big box ordinance fight itself, which took place a couple years later in the summer of 2006. And so what I'd like to add is that there was a layer of complication to this story that the research didn't address. There was a mayoral election in February of 2007. In the summer of 2006, there was a lot of speculation that Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. Would be a candidate for mayor in that race. He dropped a number of hints that was where he was heading. And when I spoke about this on the floor, I should say that I was one of the co-sponsors of the Big Box Living Wage Ordinance and voted for it on both occasions when it came before the city council, in July when it was initially considered, and in September when the mayor's veto was acted upon. And what was readily apparent to me was that this was an issue which was opportunistically co-opted by Mayor Daley as a way of dividing the African-American community in advance of the mayoral elections, to be sure that there was not a cohesive, coherent African-American community united behind Congressman Jackson. And the reason I think this is that there was an outright effort to buy support in the African-American community, which did not take place in either the Latino community or the white community. African-American organizations, and I don't use the term purchased lightly, but they were bought. African-American churches. There was a huge advertising campaign in the African-American media, which was not there in the Latino or white communities. So I think the mayor's folks decided that this was an issue that they could use to drive a wedge in the African-American community that would preclude, and that would be so bitter, the campaign would be so bitter, that it would preclude people coming together again around an African-American candidate in February of 2007. And I got up on the floor in the debate and said this, much to the chagrin of the presiding officer, who of course is the mayor. So, you know, I guess I'd say it's not just that it was intra-racial divisions in this instance, but a deliberate use of the issue to divide a community that, out of which potential opposition might grow. And that, in my view, that was the operative factor more than anything else in the Walmart battle. I said, you know, at the time that we often disagree in the council. Those disagreements are usually pretty civil, but there was an overtone of kind of viciousness to the way the Walmart campaign had been conducted, and the accusations, particularly against those of us who were supporters of the big box living wage ordinance, that we were somehow traitors to our community and traitors to the interests of the African American community, that led me to believe there was more going on there than simply Walmart's, and I continue to believe that today. Thank you.
I'm Matt McDermott. I'm the senior organizer for United Power for Action and Justice. And I thank Janet for putting our logo up earlier.
I knew you were coming.
Yeah. We are a broad-based community organization made up of congregations and local neighborhood community groups, community health centers throughout Cook County, so both city and suburbs, and across the racial and economic and religious divides of the region, including Christians and Muslims and Jews, including blacks and whites and Latinos and Asians, including city dwellers and suburbanites and people across the economic spectrum. We're built in as a sort of new generation Alinsky organization out of the Industrial Areas Foundation network that started here in Chicago in the late, sort of the tail end of Alinsky's life, and then in the late 70s pulled out of Chicago, moved its headquarters to New York, developed itself in a different political context, and then in the mid to late 90s, at the urging of Jack Egan, Monsignor Jack Egan, and a lot of others who had experience of working with the Industrial Areas Foundation, came back into Chicago to create a new kind of organization where Alinsky's early organizations had been neighborhood-based, like the Back of the Yards Neighborhood Council or TWO, the Woodlawn Organization. United Power was an attempt to build a much broader, bigger, and different kind of organization that was multi-ethnic, multi-racial, and bridged all those divides that I mentioned. So we've been around for about 10 years now and have achieved a number of important victories. A big unifying issue for the diversity of our membership has been around healthcare. And so a lot of our work has focused at the county level and then state level, because those are the entities of government that have a lot to say and develop and act upon when it comes to healthcare. But just to jump back off of that background and respond to some of the presentations, and I guess to build on the alderman's first comment about organizing being transformative, I think that's what we found in our organizing across all these different sectors and ethnic and racial and religious groups as well, that despite the very, I would say, vicious history of segregation and pitting of racial and ethnic groups against one another and neighborhoods against each other in Chicago, we've been able, inside of United Power and in and around issues like healthcare, to build what I would say is our new solidarities, new abilities for blacks and whites and Latinos to work together, and suburbanites to work on issues that many would sort of dismiss as of interest to them. So one of our early fights, in collaboration with the Service Employees Union, after we identified healthcare as an issue, they were in the midst of fighting to get suburban janitors in suburban Chicago, in office buildings in suburban Chicago, to get a new contract for the first time that would include healthcare in the contract as a benefit. downtown city janitors had health care in their contract and a wage almost twice the scale of the suburban janitors. And so it was a lot of our North Shore suburban church leaders that were critical in helping the union put pressure on building owners and members of the Building Owners and Managers Association in suburban Chicago to eventually decide, yes, they could agree to a contract with healthcare for the first time. So that was an interesting moment. We've seen that repeatedly again on a variety of issues related to expanding access to coverage for very poor and working poor parents and children in the state's design of healthcare programs and Medicaid and SCHIP. So I think that's you know, I have my certain biases in terms of believing in the way that we do our work and the way we organize our organization, but it strikes me in terms of the idea of organizing being transformative that and so many times I think what some of the organizing that's been described we might categorize occasionally as mobilizing or movement organizing. For instance, the work of the hometown associations and the mobilizing that took place around the immigrant issue under the threat of the Sensenbrenner bill and the hope of real immigration reform in the last couple of years. I think just the other day, May 1st came around again and there was another march. I don't know what the number was, but it was small, relatively speaking. I mean, I was out here when there were 500,000 people and that was astounding. But I think there have been multiple examples of major mobilization or movement organizing, whatever you want to call it, even down to the Obama campaign itself, that have been very interesting to watch, very fascinating, certainly probably are transformative to many of the immigrants, the young people, the members of different ethnic groups that experience them. What I'm sad about is that we don't have more victory stories being told today. We're talking about the big box living wage ordinance that failed. We're talking about immigration reform that remains incomplete. In some of these cases, the mobilizations are stoked in resistance to draconian types of policies or threats, like Sensenbrenner. And maybe the Obama campaign is one where it's a very different type of mobilization, but it's one that's successful, at least in the fact that he's in office. And we're seeing in our work a lot of folks emerging and coming around and interested in organizing, in part because of their experience with the Obama campaign. And I guess that's the question. You know, we're in different modes in some respects. We get occasionally criticized or critiqued, similar to maybe the way the hometown associations were critiquing the labor movement, that we're too slow, that we don't move fast enough, that we take too long to develop what we call a relational approach, trying to figure out what do people in our congregations and communities really want to take action on. And maybe sometimes that's a fair critique. And sometimes I find it also leads to different conclusions. So in the midst of the height of the mobilization of the immigrant community with the marches in downtown Chicago, organizers of ours in Lake County in Waukegan were doing work with the major Latino congregations in Waukegan and sort of assumed going in, expected that as they were talking to people, they would talk about immigration, and that was the number one issue, and the question was going to be what would the local Lake County organization be able to do about immigration? And in fact found, when they did that process of listening and talking to people, that the real pressing issue locally was about the high school, and the fact that you had Waukegan High School with 4,000 students, just, you know, in some ways people think it's improving, that the local school board is making good effort, but is a failing school. And does not prepare kids to go to college and actually only has one college counsel that speaks any Spanish for 4,000 kids. And so that became the focus of an organizing campaign between Latinos and blacks in Waukegan to fight to open a charter college prep high school. So sometimes I think different organizing processes lead to different conclusions. But I do think, and I hope, that there's a degree to which these experiences of transformation in resistance, transformation in victory, transformation in organizing, and being part of something much larger than and different than what you've been a part of before, you know, for instance, with the transnational focus that you talked about to Mexico, then carries over and creates opportunities for people to take leadership in new ways and take their citizenship and their ability to be active and creative and dynamic and shaping in the public arena farther. It strikes me that we're also in this economic time and of great peril and great upheaval, and I don't see great creative action. I'm a little bit demoralized, frankly, that in this moment of what should be or seems to be an opportunity to question to the core the way our economy operates and our market operates, that there's very little creativity and really no progress. Senator Durbin just lost a fight to change the way bankruptcies are done so that mortgages could be readjusted to keep people in their homes. He just lost a fight to restrict payday loans to 36% interest. So even where we made progress locally on immigration issues, on predatory lending restrictions, which I was part of fighting for with the Southwest Side Organization, you know, almost 10 years ago now, we're still dominated by a political system and a degree of corporate control, even when the financial sector and the banking sector are, you know, needing to be propped up and ought to be at their most humbled, but apparently are not. And it really does, the book, the thing I've been thinking about as I've been hearing the various stories today that maybe some of you have heard about or seen or read now, that's really apropos of Chicago history of organizing and resistance and this economic story, is Family Properties, which is about the history of the Contract Buyers League and the effort to fight redlining and so forth in Lawndale, that weaves the stories of the African American community and the Jewish community that had been there and the Catholic church and Catholic community as well. It's really a fascinating story that has phases of all the things I think we're talking about here today in it. There was a piece of organizing that went on that morphed eventually into a legal strategy that ultimately failed. But the legal strategy put in place the documentation and the research that allowed new national organizing to take place to create the Community Reinvestment Act and the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act and other things. A very interesting kind of creative moment where a lot began in Chicago's organizing and resistance history. I'm not quite sure how to wrap up. I've got a lot of strands. I guess my hope is that these various modes, if you will, of organizing and resistance maybe can be in a healthy tension and at the same time in an ability to feed each other and inspire each other and literally feed each other, people, leaders, folks with transformative experiences in their guts and under their belts to be able to take on the next challenges, because they're very much certainly there.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
My name is Nancy. I'm an organizer. And that's a good thing, because I'm really mad. I'm mad as hell. Dorian, Janet, and Rebecca, you talked a lot about this, the very work that we do in Logan Square, at the Logan Square Neighborhood Association, where I work, and that many of us do as organizers around the country and in the city. Janet talked a lot about trying to make sense. She kept saying, I'm not taking a side, I'm just trying to make sense. And as I listened and I tried to think about what I wanted to say, I wanted to say, I'm trying to make sense. It doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't make sense to me that Walmart, which pays non-living wages, does not pay health benefits, costs states and cities and counties money to have them come into the area, that they are the biggest employer of the Latinos, the African Americans and women in our country. That doesn't make sense to me. What did make sense was the big box ordinance that some of us worked on. Steve is sitting over there. What did make sense to me was the work we did in Logan Square to say yes to Costco, to get an agreement with them that they would hire and maintain workers from our neighborhood. I bet I'm probably the only one in the room that gets kissed every time they go to Costco. I do. Because the people there recognized that they were living in public housing, and they moved from that area of non-employment. Some of us talked about that this morning, and I'm going to touch a little bit more on Lathrop Homes in the neighborhood where I work in a minute, but it did make sense to us that those folks needed to have opportunities for jobs, and that the people in the community of Logan Square also needed opportunities for jobs, that we needed to have living wage jobs, that we needed health care, and that we needed assurances that people would not be fired as soon as the 6 months were up, as some of the other big chains did. So Costco, which has been in our neighborhood for many years now, still has folks who went through training with Logan Square Neighborhood Association and Lead Council and who are still working. That makes sense to me. The big box ordinance made sense. The mayor's veto didn't. Alderman Preckwinkle just explained to me a little bit a few minutes ago about why. But boy, was I mad when that all happened, and a lot of us were. And people in the communities really didn't see how the government was representing them. And, you know, I could go on and on, because like I said, I'm mad. But I want to say that what else doesn't make sense to me is that when we tore down public housing, and I'm not here as a proponent of saying putting lots of people, poor, disinvested people in one spot makes a lot of sense. But what doesn't make sense to me is that I work in Logan Square, and what's so great about Logan Square is it's ethnically and economically integrated. So when you hear officials talking about what they're trying to get at with the redevelopment of public housing we have in Logan Square, and what doesn't make sense to me is that it is so hard to get the investment necessary to maintain that. Because the market controls, right? And Janet talked a little bit about doing business as usual and continuing to try to get tax credits and continuing to try to get government money to build. But you know what? There's not a lot of other options. We organize every day. We march. We cry. We fight. You know, we are not a quiet group of people. But we are trying to say, let's figure out how we can continue to have an integrated neighborhood. What else doesn't make sense to me is that the only development of public housing in our community is up against $2 million homes, maybe $200 million too. I haven't seen that one. And you know, there is that kind of integration in the neighborhood. What is not there is housing for teachers, housing for police officers, housing for social workers, housing for working class people. And it's my guess that if we were able to create in Lathrop Homes, where I work, the vision that the residents there have, the residents that are left, by the way, it is almost empty. 200 units out of 700 are filled. But those residents are saying, and the ones who have left and want to come back are saying, look, what we need in our community is public housing, yes, that third. Yes, we need a third of affordable rental. We also need a third affordable home ownership, because we don't need $500,000 homes, $400,000 homes, $1 million homes. We have them all across the street. So what we're trying to say is, wouldn't this make sense? Wouldn't this economic and racial diversity that we have, couldn't we grow that? Couldn't we help it to make sense? And we're working very hard to make that into reality. And it would make sense to me for that to just be reality, for everybody to get excited and to say, wow, let's go do that, right? But it doesn't go that way. So much of what we do is a really big struggle. And that's why it makes perfect sense to me that, yes, the hometown associations marched. And by the way, I did march on Friday. I did. And it was fun. And, you know, I felt energized even though it wasn't 500,000 people, because the issues are still there. And it is my belief that now that we have an administration in Washington that might be willing to listen, we'd better organize even harder. We cannot sit down. We cannot stay home. And, you know, I felt really bad because we're broke at LSNA. And if you got an invite, you know, if I can find your name here, you'll get an invite to some fundraiser, I'm sure, because we're doing one almost every day and we're broke. But we couldn't afford buses, so we had to take the train, which is pretty easy from Logan Square. But, you know, it was hard because, of course, that meant our numbers were less, right? Because it's easier to get on a bus. But it didn't mean that the people weren't as angry. And, I was thinking about what Rebecca said, how the hometown associations organized because they felt their very being in this country threatened. And it made me think of something else that doesn't make sense. A couple weeks ago on a Friday, I was taking a vacation day, and I was at the foot of the Appalachian Trail outside of Atlanta, and I got a call. It was one of my coworkers, and he said that a friend of ours, the Migra, had come to her house at 6 o'clock that morning to get her husband. She has 2 children in Catholic school. She's 7 months pregnant. She's a citizen. They're all citizens. But he is not. The Migra chose to come to their house at 6 o'clock in the morning. They didn't take him, thank God. And because we're the Logan Square Neighborhood Association, and she means a whole lot to us, and she's a strong leader, and was a strong leader on Alderman Preckwinkle's bill, which I'm going to talk about, a different one, the Dulles Development. We pulled out all the stops, and we were able to find her an attorney, and her husband has still not been deported. But he might have been. Had it not been for the organization, he probably would be. And so that didn't make sense to me. Because this is one of the most wonderful citizens in the city of Chicago. She works hard every day. And she's looking every day for ways to make this a better city and to make ours a better world. And she helped move her husband from a life of violence into a life of fatherhood, a life of a good job. And now she's saying, oh, he's a new man. He's my man. He's my husband. We're having a new child together. We've gone through all of that. And now they're going to take him? I think not. And that didn't make sense to me, that the Migra chose to do that. So it does make sense to me when Latinos and other immigrants choose to march. And, you know, we talked about organizing, and this isn't about organizing around immigrant issues, but it is about immigrants organizing around housing issues, because in Logan Square, it is so hard to afford to live. And a lot of our homelessness in Logan Square is because many, many of our families are doubled and tripled up, because they want to stay in the neighborhood, because we've got such a strong community there. And every day in Logan Square, there's probably at least 150 parents working in classrooms, helping kids, tutoring, et cetera, et cetera. And some of them are actually going door to door to families of truant kids in the high schools and the middle schools saying, did you know your kid's not coming to school? And it's made a world of difference. We've really cut down on truancy. But anyway, so we were talking to the parents just before the final vote on the balanced development ordinance, and there was a lot of tension, and I won't go into all of it. Just explaining what was going on and explaining what we didn't think was fair, and we were explaining that one of the aldermen in our neighborhood, not far from where they were in the meeting, was really, he was calling a meeting. He's the chair of the housing committee. He was calling a meeting. He was calling what we call, along with the mayor, a lame duck city council meeting, because it was the day before the new council was going to take office. So we're talking about that. The next thing you know, it's kind of a chilly day. It was in May. The women all put on their coats and they stomped out. And the organizers ran after them, as organizers well should, because the women just went to the alderman's office. Because they were mad. And they recognized that the thing that mattered to them, whether they had citizenship or not, what mattered to them was a roof over their heads and the ability to keep their children in the schools in Logan Square. And that was not going to happen if this ordinance did not pass and if there was not a way to create more money for affordable housing. So, yes, that made sense to me. It made sense that they would, out of their own instincts, once they got the facts, and we talked about getting the facts, it made sense to me that they would go and they would organize. What didn't make sense was that the alderman, as he's been known to do a time or two, pulled his shades, locked his door, and didn't let anybody in. He didn't want to talk to his very constituents that day, because he had agreed, just like someone, those other aldermen had agreed with the mayor, to change their vote on living wage. That vote hurt their constituents. The vote that happened that watered down Alderman Preckwinkle's balanced development ordinance that we worked on together, along with Action Now and many, many others. It didn't make sense to us that he would vote against his people, but he wanted to vote with the mayor. And he actually told us, I'm going to do what the mayor tells me to do. That doesn't make sense to me. Doesn't mean the mayor is always bad. It just means that we elect 50 council members in this city. And we have work to do. We have organizing work to do. And we have a strong, strong representative group in Springfield and a strong representative group in Washington. And we have to organize. And so I appreciate these three papers because they brought out organizing that's been done and organizing that needs to continue. And in Logan Square right now, the way we'd wrap up is we'd say, si se puede, yes we can.